Hey, I'm Wes Moore, and welcome to Future City, the show that discusses the future of our city, Baltimore. What are the emerging trends? What is working? What isn't? We'll also take a broad national look at our country and approaches to certain major issues before applying them back to Baltimore. On Future City, we have covered the Makers Movement, the Confederate Monument controversy, the future of the arts, women's financial equity, and much more. You can tune into these episodes online at wypr.org/podcastcentral. But today, the future of security. We all walk around with mini computers in our pocket. Maybe we talk to virtual assistants like Alexa to play our music or tell us the weather. But how secure are these platforms? And what about day-to-day safety drills? What are we doing to ensure our places of work are safe? We'll be covering a wide variety of issues related to security, including addressing the tough questions surrounding the tension between security and privacy. First on the show, I would like to welcome Raymond A. Hanna, who is the Protective Security Advisor, the Baltimore District, for the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. It is such a joy to have you here. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So first, I just want to familiarize our listeners with your job. What kind of work do you do as part of the Department of Homeland Security?
As a DHS Protective Security Advisor, I am basically the conduit between the department and the state of Maryland. There are protective security advisors across the country, and we interface with local, state, federal governments, law enforcement, emergency management, fire, most importantly, private sector. We can get into that a little bit later. Very involved with the private sector for the flow of information going to the state and from the state that takes on specific missions. Our main mission as a protective security advisor is critical infrastructure protection. And as a PSA, it's more of a physical protection. There's cybersecurity, but the PSAs are responsible mainly for physical protection. And that takes form in the vulnerability and risk assessments. And as a DHS representative, I've participated in many assessments at much of Baltimore's critical infrastructure. For example, M&T Bank Stadium, where the Ravens play, Oriole Park, the Baltimore Convention Center, the aquarium, a lot of other. Everybody goes through bridges and tunnels most day. We have done vulnerability assessments on the bridges and tunnels. And when I say we, this is really important. DHS is merely here to support the local, state, and federal law enforcement and the first responders. We don't take over, we assist them. So when I say we, I mean we. When I do an assessment at M&T Bank Stadium, for example, we had Baltimore City Police, Fire, Emergency Management, State Police, Maryland Department of Environment, and others. It's a truly team effort.
Truly also just an all-encompassing effort. I mean, when you go down to you take your family down to the harbor, you go watch a game at M&T, you go to the aquarium with your kids, whatever the case might be, understanding how much went into you having a safe and good experience at that event, traveling down that road, seeing that piece of infrastructure is real and oftentimes not even fully appreciated, understood by the large population.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. What we try to do behind the scenes is to look at every contingent, every threat, every vulnerability to mitigate, hopefully stop the vulnerabilities. Nothing is 100% fail-proof as far as safe, but believe me, a lot of very dedicated people in the state of Maryland are trying to make that experience as safe and as enjoyable for the public as possible.
So let's cover some of the biggest changes that you've seen in your time as being a security professional. What are, you know, a couple of the most radical changes that have happened during your time and during your career as a security professional?
I would say the one that comes to mind the most would be the internet. In my prior career, I've been a PSA in Maryland for 13 years. I retired from the United States Secret Service as a special agent in 2005. In my career in the Secret Service, I held positions at field offices doing criminal investigations, counterfeit, credit card fraud, threats against the president, obviously. But we also did the protection. Everybody knows most recognizably my four-year permanent protection, and I'm dating myself, was on Vice President Al Gore. From there, I went to headquarters, and I was in our major events division. I'm sure you've heard of National Special Security Events, where the Secret Service is the lead agency. DHS is the department over the Secret Service. And we, in the major events division, we did the NSSE events. In fact, the Super Bowl in New Orleans, just after 9/11, they decided it was going to be a national special security event because of the events of 9/11. I was actually the site agent at the Superdome for the Super Bowl and the events leading up to the Super Bowl that week. I spent probably 3 months off and on in New Orleans preparing security with the local, state, federals, and the NFL.
And it also includes things like trainings. Trainings even of private sectors. And you know, you even came here to the station for an active shooter workshop after the tragic events that took place in Annapolis with the Capital Gazette. How much of a part of that, of your portfolio and the portfolio for DHS, has that become?
Absolutely. And as I stated before, there are different missions within the PSA mission. And I mentioned assessments. The second one is training. The active shooter training from DHS, we use the run, hide, fight methodology. Other jurisdictions, other federal agencies have different names for it, but it's all basically the same. And when I go out, as I did here at the station, and provide an active shooter presentation, I'm very quick to point out to the attendees there are two types of active shooter training. One that law enforcement will go through, obviously weapons, protective gear, tactics. That is not what I teach. I teach normal, everyday citizens at their workplace, what to expect, how best, what options you have. And the thing I really like to point out, and I think it's commendable, is when WYPR invited me here, or when a school invites me, or a business invites me, and I've probably done over 150 active shooter presentations in the last couple years, I think it's commendable they're having this training for their employees. But I'm very quick to point out, this is not classified information. This is information that everybody should know and should use no matter where they're at. One of the first things I do in a training is I ask the people and ask them to either shake their head or raise their hand. Have you been to a shopping mall in the last couple weeks? Have you been to a movie? Have you gotten gas in your car? Have you gone to the bank? Have you turned your water on your house? Do your kids go to school? Do you go to church? And they all say yes. And I say, those are the places you visit every day. I want you to think about this wherever you go, wherever your kids go, when your families go. So I ask people to think about it. No matter where you're at, you can use this. And the key thing is DHS does not expect you to take down a gunman, whether it's a criminal act or whether it's an active shooter or whether it's a terrorist act. However, if you've heard the campaign, and I hope everybody's heard of it in the Baltimore area, if you see something, say something. MTA, for example, in Baltimore, you probably notice the posters or the TV commercials that have the elephant sitting on a briefcase, the elephant in the room, or BWI, they'll have a package sitting out by itself. DHS does that program for businesses. They've partnered with the NFL, the National Hockey League, Major League Baseball. In fact, I have helped the Ravens and the Orioles. They have an If You See Something, Say Something program. Navy Marine Corps Stadium in Annapolis, Maryland, where the U.S. Naval Academy plays. Their scoreboard before every game, they have it up on the screen. If you see something, say something.
If someone says to you, I think that the United States is fundamentally more dangerous now than it was 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago. Accurate statement, alarmist statement, inaccurate statement, where do you fall on that?
I would not use the word dangerous. I would use the word different. We alluded to before with the internet. Now with cable news, it's a 24-hour news cycle. Immediately when something happens, you have former professionals for agencies, and they're not in those agencies anymore, and they offer opinions and assumptions, and sometimes they're right. Sometimes they don't have all the information. The internet. Back when I was a kid anyway, I'm much older than you. Back when I was a kid, if you wanted to learn how to make a bomb, you went to the library and you signed out the Anarchist Cookbook. And in that book, it actually showed you how to make an explosive. Now we forward to year 2018, and you can go on the internet or the dark internet, and you can put a search on IEDs, improvised explosive device. You can find articles online on the regular internet and the dark internet, how to make an explosive device. I highly recommend none of your listeners Google how to make an IED on their home computers, though.
Because it'll draw a lot of attention.
I'm just saying, I don't recommend it.
When you think about how this field has evolved in your time of seeing the varying shapes, even kind of the whole creation of the Department of Homeland Security. And when you think about where this is going to go, how we continue to adapt our SOPs, our standing operating procedures based on the threats, and how even as you said, we think differently now about active shooters than we did when Columbine happened. How do we go about preparing the public for these changes, educating them, but at the same time managing to keep them sane?
So I'm glad you asked that point. I alluded to it earlier with the private sector and with law enforcement. Back when 9/11 happened, local law enforcement didn't necessarily talk to state law enforcement or share information with them. State law enforcement didn't necessarily talk to or share information with federal. And I know firsthand, because I've been in this business for 35 years, that federal agencies didn't necessarily talk to each other. And one fact, the private sector was really never involved in making themselves safe. 85% of all critical infrastructure in our country is owned by the private sector. Therefore, you need to include them in the solution. They know what they're trying to protect. They know the dangers of what they're doing. If they're a chemical company, they know what the chemicals are. They're the experts. So now I'm proud to say I'm part of a law enforcement community where local police, state police, federal law enforcement all talk to each other, all share information. We have many, many different forums in Maryland where law enforcement, along with the private sector, get together and talk about security. We talked about it before for the plan of special events, whether it's the 4th of July, down at the Inner Harbor, or New Year's Eve. We've been planning for a year. There's all types of private and public law enforcement, government, fire agencies working together as a team to make everybody as safe as possible. And that should give some comfort to the general public. As far as the general public, I think the best thing they can do is, yes, things happen. As I mentioned, the media, you hear it much quicker and in much greater quantity now than you did 20 years ago. The internet, everybody's plugged in the internet, Twitter and Facebook. So you hear these things, but I guess my message would be, yes, be aware, get some training, listen to things, watch out for programs. Like if you see something, say something, but go about your business every day. The chances of being caught in a terrorist attack or an actor are very slim, but we have to continue to do it because it is possible. I would like to mention all the things I talked about, the active shooter training, the vulnerability assessments, awareness, you can go online to DHS.gov, DHS.gov, and you can click. There's information in there for the general public, and they can click on and watch the Run, Hide, Fight video that DHS did against active shooter. In fact, I show it every time I give an active shooter presentation. Anybody listening today can go onto that website and find tons of information that will help them feel more informed and take responsibility for their own safety. One thing I like to point out is, do you remember a few years ago in New York when the person at Times Square had the vehicle and it smoked? Thank God for all of us that it was a dud that didn't explode. But do you know the first person that reported that? As many police officers as there are in New York, it was a hot dog vendor. A hot dog vendor saw that, knew it wasn't right, and immediately called the authorities. The chances of law enforcement being every place at every minute is pretty slim. But if, for example, I like to do in my presentations, if you go to a mall, you may have 10 security officers on a shift, which is good. And they're trained. They're looking for suspicious things. That's 10 set of eyes. Now, if you train all the employees of the mall, all the anchor stores, you've multiplied that at any given time from 10 to probably 300. Now, if you put active DHS, if you see something, say something programs, or you the general public gets a little, not formal, just a little general training on awareness, and you have 2,000 people at the mall. That's 2,000 sets of eyes that can look in the parking lot and see something that stands out. And so you tell people what to look for and how to report it.
Raymond A. Hanna, who's a protective security advisor for the Baltimore District of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. This has been fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And thanks for your service. If you're just tuning in, you've been listening to Future City, and I'm Wes Moore. On this show, we're addressing the future of security. Coming up next, personal security and technology. With nearly all of us carrying around pocket-sized computers and many holding all of our personal information, and many of us investing in smart cybersecurity systems for our homes, how are we staying safe? How is technology both the purveyor of and the destroyer of our security? Stay tuned. Hey, I'm Wes Moore, and welcome back to Future City. On today's show, we're asking, what's the future of security? And nothing says the future like Jetsons-like images of smart home hubs and drones delivering packages, savvy internet-run security systems. And all these are real, and they're happening right now. But how secure are they? What can they offer us? And what are the risks? On the line now to talk with us about this is Mark Vina, who is a senior analyst for smart home, home automation, security, and console gaming, more insights and strategy. Mark, thank you so much for joining us.
Wes, glad to be here.
So Mark, we live in a world that seems to be getting more and more connected through technology, and we're using that technology for our home and our business security systems. So what trends are you seeing right now that really excite you?
Well, like you said, Wes, I mean, we're really in a brave new world with connected devices. By 2020, there's going to be over 200 billion connected devices that people are using. You know, the average U.S. home today has 2025 Internet of Things class devices, and security obviously is a huge deal. You know, one of the trends I'm seeing right now, let's look at security cameras, for example. That's one of the fastest growing categories. They're very inexpensive. You can't go anywhere, you know, without seeing a smart doorbell like Ring or other products like it. But with some of the real cool technology that's coming along to make that security stuff even more secure and more useful is the technology is going to have the capability to not only understand what it's seeing in the field of view. For example, in today's cameras, for example, see someone enter a scene that you can record on a clip and then play it back after the fact. What I'm really excited about is our cameras like, for example, there's a company out there called Lighthouse that makes this great product that not only sees things, of course, in the field of view, but can make distinctions between children, adults, different type of people. And when you layer on, you know, smart algorithms and artificial intelligence and learnings and things like that, you'll be able, you know, hopefully at one point you'll be able to get notifications like send me an alert when someone falls down in the living room, for example, or send me an alert when you see two children fighting. So, you know, the security camera is not just going to become a passive device. It's really morphing into a device that allows people to get these proactive alerts when something happens. So I'm particularly excited about that. The other thing in security that I think is going to be very, very cool, but you know, users are going to have to really embrace this, is not to just look at security within the home, especially within your computer network, like just a device that you purchase and you kind of forget about it. That more and more routers and more computer technology that's using to distribute internet access within the home is getting smarter. And if you look at products like Plume Networks has this great mesh network networking capability that understands, frankly, at the device level, you know, and it can detect for intrusions and bad activity that's going on. And that's incredibly important, frankly, because people are adding so many different devices to their home. There's a company out there called Cognitive Systems that uses Wi-Fi sensing that actually uses Wi-Fi and RF activity, radio modulation, to understand what's going on in the home. And that has dramatic, significant potential for being able to determine certain actions that are going on in the home and even outside the home as well. So those just are a couple of trends that are going on.
So when you're talking about smart homes, so what exactly does an automated home look like? Like what sort of features are included in an automated home?
I think the way most people define an automated home today is really just the rise of products like digital assistants like Amazon Alexa or Google Home or Apple Siri. And I'll use Amazon Alexa because that's probably the most compelling example because it's so popular. People are using that device to automate various systems within the home, whether they're using it in conjunction with, for example, their Nest thermostat to maintain the air conditioning in their home, and they can control it automatically using their voice. You know, I happen to use my Amazon Alexa to control all the different lights in my home. So when I walk into the home, I just say, Alexa, please turn on the lights. And there you go, the lights turn on, and they'll turn off at a certain time. So really, the way I kind of define the digital home is taking these disparate devices, whether they're thermostats, well, whether they're, you know, your music player, whether there's other different types of devices, and using some type of voice capability to manage those devices. So I think that's the classic definition, the way most consumers would define it.
So even thing like these Amazon keys.
Yes. So Amazon offered the capability. It did get a lot of pushback in the marketplace. Some people were not really that thrilled about the fact that you'd authorize Amazon to enter your home. But with the right smart lock technology within your home, and with the right authorization that you would do with Amazon, you know, rather than leaving a package on your front door, you could actually authorize Amazon to unlock your home, drop the package off inside the home, lock the door, and then leave. So that's really, really interesting. I'm personally, from my vantage point, I'm a bit skeptical whether many consumers will accept that. There's a lot of other things they've accepted from Amazon, and they love the business model in terms of ordering things and having things delivered directly to their home. But that's really, to me, you know, I don't want to say it's George Jetson, but it's certainly very, very ambitious, I think, for Amazon to think that many consumers are going to go for that, to be quite honest with you.
Do most Americans have an in-home security system?
Most Americans don't have a system. I mean, the number is growing. It depends on how you define it. The fastest growing category within U.S. retail right now is the smart camera category. There's a lot of entrants in it. A lot of them have Me Too-like products. There's not a tremendous amount of differentiation between the two. You know, to your point about Amazon Alexa before, in terms of the way it ties into the home, in terms of your home profile, a lot of these systems don't work really well in a very seamless type of way with your digital assistant. Amazon Alexa is probably the best one best system that's out there. But you know, I think most consumers are still, you know, kind of testing the waters in terms of, you know, how much security do I want. There also is the issue too with security cameras. Just to get back on that topic for a second, you know, some consumers struggle with the privacy issues. Do I really want to have a camera inside my home? They're okay, by the way, with having cameras on the outside of the home, and you know, using again the Ring doorbell, which just got recently acquired. Ring is an incredibly popular product because, again, most people do want to know when someone's at the door. So I think the external camera category is probably the most popular right now, and it's a category that's growing very, very quickly.
One thing I think when Americans are looking at how quickly these things are evolving, There are a lot of questions and concerns also about, you know, about security, where, you know, as we're walking around with our smartphones, you're walking around with devices that are you know, as technologically impressive as the computer that's sitting on your desk. But many people would argue that you're also walking around things that are tracking your movement, that are listening to your conversations, that are doing all these other things, and that people are wondering about the security measures around that. So when you hear that, what can we do to make sure that we are staying secure online? And for the people who have those cautions and concerns, are they fair and are they legit?
Oh, they're absolutely legit and they're absolutely reasonable. And I think you asked a couple of questions embedded in one question, but well, let me take them on. The first question is that consumers have to do a much better job of taking ownership of their, you know, their cyber responsibility built around security. There's still too many consumers that take consumer computer technology in too much of a casual way. And the first thing people need to do is, you know, is really kind of lock down their passwords. It would be shocking to you to find out how many people still use a very, you know, easy to understand, easy to hack type passwords. We've seen it even at the government level with certain government officials. But, you know, the first thing people really need to do is go out and get a password manager like that. Dashlane's a good one. OnePass is a good one. There's a number of them that are really great out there. And lock down your passwords so you can have very sophisticated passwords, but at the same time, it doesn't become overly complex in terms of managing them. The other thing that it just drives me crazy is that people still don't use antivirus software in a secure way. They buy a computer at Best Buy, for example. They bring that computer home, and after the trial version of the software runs out, they never subscribe to a security package. So that's the other thing that they could do. And then finally, you know, I talked about a couple of other products that are very exciting in the router sphere. Norton has a terrific router called Core that's completely built around security. The Norton Core router is a terrific product that really, you know, specializes on security, focused on the Internet of Devices dynamic that's happening in today's home. Plume Networks is doing the same thing, offering mesh capabilities. Not only do you have much greater Internet coverage within your home, you also, at the same time, it's doing a great job of detecting and managing threats that are coming from the outside in terms of all those Internet of Things devices. So there are things that people can do because the most serious thing that I see, Wes, in the security realm is that when someone gets hacked, sometimes they don't even know it for months or maybe even years at a time. And that's really the most the pernicious thing about, you know, cybersecurity is that, you know, you can get your account hacked, you can get your identity stolen and may not know about it for months. And by that time, it's really too late to recover. So, well, you know, you cannot completely prevent attacks. It's not a 100% foolproof thing. I really would like to see consumers, you know, look at home security in much more of kind of like a homeowner's insurance or renter's insurance. I mean, you've got to have it. You've got to take it in a very serious way. Make some very modest and reasonable investments in certain types of software and hardware technology, and it will do a really good job of thwarting off the most pernicious attacks.
Mark Vina, the senior analyst for smart home, home automation, security, and console gaming, more insights and strategy. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Hey, thank you, Wes.
You've been listening to Future City. I'm Wes Moore. And coming up, we're confronting the tension between security and freedom. Just how much of our autonomy are we willing to give up in the name of safety? And what are the legal implications of all of this? Coming up after the break, stay tuned. Hey, I'm Wes Moore, and welcome back to Future City, the show where we ask the question, what's next for our city and for our country? And on today's show, we've been discussing the future of security in our homes, in our businesses, all around us. And now we're going to be asking some big questions about what this all means when it comes to tensions between privacy and personal freedom. Joining us now is Charles Harry, the Associate Research Professor at the Center for International and Security Studies at the University of Maryland. Professor Harry, it is so good having you here. Thanks so much for making the time.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate the invitation.
Well, so we're really excited about this topic, but first I ask that you familiarize our listeners with the work that you do. So what do you teach in the Security Studies program?
So at the University of Maryland in the School of Public Policy is where I sit. I teach basically a couple of different subjects, primarily in international security policy and cybersecurity policy. And what we're primarily interested in is the intersection between economics, between technology, as well as traditional hard power.
So when you say the interaction between economics, technology, traditional hard power, what exactly does that mean?
Oh, that's a great question. So in essence, if you think about traditional studies of international relations and international security, we tend to think of things like tanks, planes, you know, what we would call hard power. But the reality is that over the past 50 years, 60 years, we've seen an evolution in the security environment. So it's no longer just about who can field the largest number of tanks. It also includes things like who has control and or stability in economic flows, who is able to influence various nations on issues of ecology. So climate change is a security problem because changes to the climate do lead to things like social instability potentially. So all of these factors come together to form a more complicated international security environment.
And you talked about the issue of cyber specifically. How secure are we right now from a national perspective on cyber?
So it's a very good question. It's actually a fairly complex question. So it's, obviously any of us who, read a newspaper or certainly watch a television program understand that there are a variety of different cyber attacks that we see on any given day. And so the answer, it's a little complicated. We are certainly vulnerable in a lot of different areas, especially to critical infrastructure. But the scale is something that we really need to truly understand. So the vast, vast majority of cyber attacks that we see are what I would characterize more of nuisance attacks. There are things like website defacements, where someone gets access to your web server and they put up, hey, I don't like you, or usually it's a little bit more colorful than that. But it's not that big of a deal. You can change it back in 5 minutes. It's embarrassing, but it's not going to turn the power off. However, there are a certain number of attacks that are highly targeted and that have extreme disruptions. I'll give you a good example. So in 2017, it was in June 2017, there was an introduction of a computer virus, what we would call ransomware. It has the ability to disrupt computer hard drives in particular. And it was introduced through a tax accounting software update in the Ukraine. And it was ostensibly done by Russian actors. The reason it's important is that when it was introduced into that tax software update, so think of QuickBooks or a TurboTax update onto your computer, it got itself into a variety of different firms in the Ukraine, one of which was a regional hub for Maersk Line, which is the largest container ship company in the world. It's run out of Denmark. When it got into their network, it moved laterally and infected several very, very important servers. Those particular servers managed all port operations for basically their container movement operations across the world. It shut down over 70 ports for 2 days, and then they were able to bring most of them back up with the exception of seven. One of those ports was the port of Rotterdam in Europe, and it shut it down for roughly 2 weeks. Now, this had huge implications for the supply chain in parts of Central Europe. So again, while the vast majority of cyber attacks are more of a nuisance, there are a handful that are extremely disruptive. And just to give you a sense of how much money we're talking about, just for Maersk Line, it cost them $300 million in direct remediation costs. And direct costs to their bottom line to resolve this problem from the NotPetya attack. And there were several other firms that had similar stories, but that one in particular highlights that sometimes what starts off as a private problem becomes a very large public concern.
So is this a future of warfare?
Absolutely. I think it is used in conjunction with other forms of attack to generate, fairly significant effects where it's primarily useful are countries that have traditionally weak hard power assets. They don't have as many planes. They don't have as many tanks. But if they have an ability to be highly direct and highly targeted, they can create substantial damage to a much larger power.
You know, what's really interesting about this is when you think about traditional warfare, when you think about, hard assets, there's not much that a nation can ask its citizenry to do to better prepare themselves or to better make themselves a harder target, right? What it's really asking is that you support the military and you can, you know, support the economy or whatever the case might be, so that you're then allowing your military to perform the external force and the external actions that then need to take place. This is different. There are actually things that citizens can do to make themselves and make our nation a harder target.
Yeah, I mean, just to give you an example, some of the most sensitive areas that we're most concerned about as a government are things that we call critical infrastructure. This would be things like the electrical grid or, water networks, transportation networks. 85% of the critical infrastructure in the United States is controlled by private corporations and companies. And so most of us work for, a variety of different companies. And so you may find yourself, let's say, working in the human resources department at BG&E. You're not a power engineer. So maybe you don't think that you're very much, you would be considered a target. But if I'm a hacker, I'm potentially going to target you. And if I can trick you to click on a link and get me access even to your computer, they could potentially run through your computer to move to more sensitive parts of the network. And so that's an area that additional education about what the threats are and potentially how to remediate those threats is extremely important. So absolutely, the more that citizens can become aware of the various threats, then, we're probably better off. A good example would be in Estonia. The Estonians have a very, very sophisticated program of public education in the area of cyber. And the reason is because they've been under assault by the Russians for quite some time. So I think the Estonians are a really good example of how the public can educate themselves and in partnership with the government to make for a safer society.
So you bring up Estonia as an example, and I'm really curious about this idea of what countries do you think have struck that balance well of being able to have the hard conversation with the public about what the public can do to better support the efforts, about helping the public to understand the nature of the problem, and being able to enlist the public to really be, your frontline defenders and supporters. Where are some places that we can look to learn from when we think about how to think about the future of this warfare threat?
Yeah, I think this is a really important topic that you're raising. The one thing that I would highlight, and we touched on a little bit earlier, is that there's this evolution in the security environment. So it's no longer just about hard power assets. It's understanding the nature of economics. It's understanding the nature of diplomacy. It's even cultural issues are all coming together to form a new security environment. So when I look at potential other models around the world, and some of which I've had the opportunity to travel to, I'm really struck by what the Baltic states have done. I really do like what Estonia is doing, especially in the area of cyber. They really have moved forward by still adopting a lot of the technology that basically improves people's lives. But at the same time, they're very mindful of the security concerns. And they're doing a lot of different things to provide general levels of awareness of potential information warfare or propaganda usage. But at the same time, they're educating a lot of their corporations about what those threats potentially are and increasing their investment of security as part of their normal operations. I think another good example would be in Singapore. Singapore this last year passed their Cybersecurity Act. And one of the things that was really, I thought, quite extraordinary was that they, in essence, open sourced or crowdsourced commentary on the act to see how they might better improve cybersecurity in Singapore. So for about a year, there was a period by which anyone worldwide could actually write comments on the bill itself and how they might actually be able to improve cybersecurity for critical infrastructure. And one of the things that came out of that, which I thought was really quite fascinating, was this ability to be much more direct in understanding how the networks that support the critical infrastructure are given some sort of broad oversight by the government. What I mean by that is that when we talk about critical infrastructure, we usually talk at this very high level. We talk about, well, yes, we need to, you know, protect the power grid. Yes, but there are very specific computers and very specific networks that manage those things. So how do we as a government, whether it's the federal government or a state and local government, interact with those private companies to actually make sure that they've accounted for a lot of these risks? And I think Singapore actually did a really interesting thing. And so that's something that we may look to in the future for, trying to at least crowdsource some, the most positive contributions from the private sector to the public sector.
Yeah, I would argue that it's not even just on the security element. I think that model is fascinating when you're looking at all conversations about policy and movement.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So let's talk about authentication security. How far along is it and how effective is it?
Well, that's a good question. So obviously, there are a lot of people in this space that are doing work in biometrics and some applications of blockchain. But the vast, vast majority of companies out there are using good old-fashioned passwords. And the real problem there is, especially from a hacking point of view, is that we tend to think of hacking as a highly technical, highly complex set of activities, usually someone with a hoodie in their basement, right? Something along those lines. But the interesting thing about cybersecurity is it's a multidisciplinary field. And some of the best hackers basically are going after the humans. Can I trick you to reveal your password? Or can I trick you to give me information about your background? And we use basically pre-programmed human frailties and vulnerabilities to do so. So, for instance, when I stand in front of my students at the University of Maryland on the very first day of class, I might ask them a little, to tell me a little bit about themselves. So what if I ask them, tell me where you were born, or tell me what your birthday is. Tell me what your favorite color is or what the name of your first pet is. Now, they see that as, oh, we're just getting to know each other. But what I could have done is utilized my position as an authority figure to compel them to tell me information that they potentially have used as challenge questions on an account that they've signed up for. And I oftentimes will use this to demonstrate the power of social engineering. There was a great video that was recently done at the DEF CON conference, which is one of the hacking conferences out in Las Vegas. And they sat a gentleman down, and they basically, this very nice lady said, I can, within 5 minutes, compromise your account for, I think it may have been Verizon or something along these lines. And he just kind of said, okay, and he gave his permission to do so. And the lady did a fantastic job of calling customer service, had a recording of a crying baby in the background, and basically played on the desire for the customer service agent to be helpful, which is a human trait. And not only did this person get access to the account, but she was able to add her name and change the existing password to get direct access to all the financial information that this individual had. And it really, really highlighted that hacking is very much a human endeavor. So when we talk about authentication security, we're not as far as we'd like to be, of course. But even if we do get there, we can't take out the human element. And that is absolutely fundamental.
When you think about where this field was when you were a student at University of Colorado, Boulder, and you think about where the field is now, how fast is this field of security changing? How fast, how much of what you learned even when you were a college student has now become irrelevant when you're thinking about the pace of change that this is happening?
I think it's an excellent question. Obviously, the speed by which technology is evolving is serving to transform what we think about security. I can tell you, I'm obviously a little bit older, but at the end of the day, what we've seen even in 20, 25 years is a complete transformation, even just in cybersecurity, because 20 years ago, we didn't have cloud computing. We didn't have the iPhone and the transformation of mobile computing. Now what we're talking about is the use of predictive analytics and machine learning, but also, you know, artificial intelligence and AI issues. And so where I really see this really coming into play is that corporations are moving to these incredibly complex, what we would call attack surfaces. Because it used to be 20, 25 years ago, if you had a computer network, it was, you know, basically in your physical location. You bought a bunch of computers and, you know, it within the four walls of your office, that was your network. But the world today is very different. Your network, actually, most of those applications may be hosted in Ireland. They may be hosted in somewhere in Asia. And you're taking advantage of this highly distributed type of computing that's really been on the rise over the last 10 years. And what that has done is it's spread out your assets. And there's different ways to attack you if I'm a malicious actor. And so where I see this going, especially when we talk about things like smart cities, right, and we talk about the adoption of a lot of smart technology, is that there are some real deep concerns about the security to things like autonomous systems that and autonomous vehicles that are being leveraged to a great degree to improve transportation and human welfare. These are all great and wonderful things. But we have to understand that all of that infrastructure is being supported by networks. And as that gets distributed, and there are different ways for us to go and potentially attack it, we have to be mindful of that. So I'm not an alarmist. In fact, I love technology. I'd love to adopt it. I love my IoT devices in my home. But I'm also aware of what the security problems potentially are.
My final question for you is this is actually piggybacks on that answer. It's striking the balance about what to share with the larger population. Mm-hmm. There are things that are going on where, you know, I remember once I heard President Obama make a statement where, you know, that first day where after he became the president-elect and he received his first real security briefing, where he actually got a chance to understand, like, not like little security, but like, this is what's going on in the world right now. And how humbling that was, kind of getting a full breakdown of the amount of threats that are then facing the United States. And now you're the person who's in charge of that. How do we think about this balance with the American people about letting them know the seriousness in which we should take this, letting them know their role in preparing for it, but at the same time still allowing them to sleep at night when you think about all that's going on?
No, I think it's an important question. So the one thing that I try to impart upon my students is this notion of scale and this notion of risk. So is it conceivable that I'm going to get in a traffic accident on any given day? Yes, it is. And to tell you the truth, there's a higher degree of risk in having a traffic accident than is being killed in a terrorist event. Is it possible that the lights are going to get turned out in the Baltimore region from a cyber attack? Yes, it is, but it's probably not likely. And so as we think about security, while it's important to understand the range of threats, we need to put it in its proper context. And it's also important for us to understand how the world is incredibly complex. But in general, like-minded people around the world want to try to build a better world. And we should continue to partner. We should build institutions. We should work through those processes to in essence, try to build a world in which we take advantage of the best parts of technology and innovation, but actually reduce the overall set of threats that we face.
Charles Harry, the Associate Research Professor at the Center for International and Security Studies at the University of Maryland, this has been a joy. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
So before we wrap up, I just want to leave with a few thoughts. There are so many things about our future living, future homes, smart businesses that get us all excited. Art changing on the walls depending on your mood. Temperatures changing in a room when you walk into it. Packages being delivered in an hour and not in 3 days. It's really cool stuff. But we also have to acknowledge the reality that with every innovation, we have to be willing to address the potential threat that it unravels. We need to acknowledge that these innovations often happen at the expense of personal liberty and privacy. And while we must demand that our governments do their part to put up safeguards, we also must be willing to do our part as well. If the future of warfare really is and includes cyber warfare, we all have to be warriors in this fight. We have to be our own hard targets. As I listened to Professor Charles Harry talk about this, I realized how much more I personally need to pay attention to this. This should be a wake-up call for everybody, because I know it was for me. Our future cities are ones that embrace new smart technologies, but are also prepared to dismantle any threats that will use these as openings or opportunities to compromise our independence. Future City is produced and edited by Katie Marquette, and I want to give a special shout out to our superstar intern, Nina Bowman. The show airs the third Wednesday of the month at 1 p.m. and then again at 9 p.m. You can listen to this show along with previous episodes online at wypr.org/podcastcentral. You can connect with me directly online as well on Twitter or on Instagram at @IamWesMoore. For 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station, I'm Wes Moore, and thanks for listening.